Welcome.
Crash. Boom.
Ka-thunk, chunk, ka-thunk, ka-thunk, ka-thunk. Professional show business.
What did you just call this theme music? A special guest?
It sounds like a demented Christmas song from Smurfs Village.
I'll take it.
I'm okay with that. That does actually... Would Blue mind that? I think he wouldn't mind that.
I don't know that you put it on the poster, but no, I'm sure he's...
I was debating on whether to tell you guys that because I didn't want to hurt Blue's feelings.
No, look, I'm sure he's happy to be noticed. It's only worse to not be talked about.
This is Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for Movies.com.
I'm Alonso Duraldi, film critic for TheWrap.com and What the Flick on YouTube. And joining us today, our very special guest, someone who does this sort of thing for a living and much more slickly, from the Stephanie Miller Show, Chris Lavoie is here.
Howdy! Howdy! Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Wearing his Linoleum Knife shirt and everything.
Of course I am.
He's booking to have a picture taken. Yes, before he leaves. It will be... Look on our social media. You'll see.
We were told... not long ago, that any guest we had, we were supposed to take a picture with them.
Yes.
And post it. Like, right. That was going to be a thing that would be a marketing...
People love that.
Thing.
Yeah. Believe me.
For us. And we were like, okay, sure, yeah. And then, since then, we've had like two or three guests, and each time they leave, and when they leave and walk out the door, we go, oh yeah, I forgot to get a picture. But now, you're wearing the shirt.
I'm wearing the swag.
So,
yeah,
so you're basically...
We're taking a picture.
It's going to happen.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And you'll be the first time we've ever employed human body of a guest
as a social media tactic.
As a social media tactic.
Wow. Yeah. Eve, I'm surprised you guys didn't do Rachel True.
I know, we're kicking ourselves with that.
We're literally pimping you.
You know what?
With this.
I'm happy to be pimped. Yeah.
For those who don't know, the Stephanie Matto...
Stephanie Matto.
Yeah, you know, they're two lesbians.
Yeah, same difference. Stephanie Miller Show is recorded here in Los Angeles. It is syndicated nationally on Sirius XM, on Free Speech TV, mm-hmm. and in radio and markets around the country.
That's right.
And it's a funny show.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm a fan. I have always enjoyed it, and I miss not having it on LA terrestrial radio.
Yeah, we miss being not being on LA terrestrial radio as well. But we're soldiering on, and we talk about politics in a funny kind of way.
Yeah,
we're a wacky morning show with politics.
And now you're working Blue with a podcast.
Yes.
have you heard their podcast?
The Stephanie Miller Happy Hour podcast.
Are there swears?
Oh, lots of swears.
It is. Filthy.
We debated before we started this podcast back and forth, like, were we going to be ourselves and constantly using profanity?
Right.
Because if you are in this home for more than 5 minutes, you're going to hear all the words.
Yes. I heard all the words while you were making pancakes.
Yes. But then, like, when we started the podcast, I thought, why don't we make a challenge to ourselves? Why don't we challenge ourselves to not swear on this podcast?
Right.
To make it clean so that people can drive around with it in their car, and maybe their 5-year-old
with their kids
can learn to love, you know,
giant gay men who love movies.
Ingmar Bergman, you know. And so I don't know that it's been successful in that. I mean, I don't know that any parent who listens to the show has ever said to us, oh, we're so happy you're clean.
Well, no, we did get a nice letter from somebody who said that when their, like, 5-year-old hears the theme music, they say, podcast or something.
Oh, okay. That's right.
I'll take that.
That did happen. But, yeah, we debate back and forth. Every once in a while, we go back and forth and think, why don't we just
Oh, well, no.
Let's just loosen it up.
No, once we're in, we're in.
You know? No, yeah.
And you know, you restrict yourself with downloads because some people have like the safe search on or whatever on iTunes.
Oh, well, there you go.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. You know, they don't want to be handed
now,
explicit
content.
Now,
iTunes just was ragging on us because
they didn't think we should be using Clean because
we discuss adult subjects.
Well, they weren't specific as to why. I mean, they could
well,
have
that's been, because the only that's the only
well
explanation.
they could have talked about the time that I sort of but didn't quite swear because it was really,
and then you forgot to bleep it out.
Yes, but it was really more of a wordplay thing. So,
okay, all right.
You know, I think I would go to court on that one. Anyway,
I'm just like, you know. I feel constricted sometimes when I want to say...
You got to be free.
When I want to say all the Fs.
You should start another podcast like the Stephanie Miller Show.
I've got a lot of Fs in my soul.
You've been working around it very well.
Aww.
The, okay, so we have a lot of movies.
Yes, it is. I hate when there's a late Thanksgiving. It ruins everything. it shortens the Thanksgiving to Christmas window, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the most wonderful time of the year.
That's why in our home we've already begun Christmasing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know, nobody got time to wait for the 27th.
No.
That's crazy.
No.
Or whenever Thanksgiving is this year, but it's too late.
Since the middle of November I've been doing something Christmas related every day mm-hmm. to prepare, to plan, to you know, make it awesome.
I just bought you the Martha Stewart Living Christmas
today.
Issue.
I sent Alonzo to the store this morning for pancake making ingredients.
Yep,
and he returned with the Martha Stewart Living December issue
and the pancake making
with which I will begin the war on Christmas.
Yes,
there's this great 2-page spread of Martha like. Reclining in bed.
She
with
is
her, like,
she's lounging
sheets.
In bed in her holiday sheets that you can buy at Macy's.
Yeah,
that's sexy.
It you is cougar get, time.
You want to get it with Martha Stewart when you look at that ad. Well, I want to get those sheets.
Exactly. Yeah,
those are going to be preppy sensualists.
I want that duvet.
She was angling for a stable boy in her backyard.
I just, you know, back on her when her show was on.
The second one.
The daily, the show that was on every day.
Right.
With the studio audience.
With the studio audience. Every time she'd have a rapper on, she would flirt.
Oh, super
flirty.
Yeah.
With Snoop and with Ludacris, and I'd be like...
Seth Meyers.
She's, yeah.
She would flirt with him till the
cows came off. Yeah. Every time I would see a rapper on the show, I'd think, they're going to have a quiet dinner later. Like, I knew in my head.
And then they're
going
to the after party.
Yeah. She can have whatever she wants.
Allegedly.
She can have whatever she wants.
Yeah.
You know she can.
True.
I bet you. It's all speculation on my part. But
wow.
I bet you. And they're doing it on those Macy's Christmas sheets.
And you know, yeah. I bet Martha has a handmaiden.
Oh.
Do you know about this? This was introduced to me. Okay, so adult film legend, we're really testing the Clean part. Adult film legend Nina Hartley came on
yes.
with a flick a couple times to talk about Masters of Sex.
Right.
And she mentioned at some point there's this thing called handmaidening, which is basically someone who is in the room where sex is taking place, whether it's just two people or a group of people.
Right.
And all that person does is provide towels, water, you know,
okay.
Open packet of, you know, prophylactics.
Non-lube covered hands.
Like a sex valet, basically.
Wow. All right.
And that's a thing. Like, it has a name, and people do it, and they're into it.
Is it a career, or is it just a stepping stone to something else?
I think it's more a hobby.
Okay.
You know.
It might be under the list of duties of a personal assistant, if you have, like...
That's true.
I know, we have a couple friends who listen to this show. I know. Who have money. And I think that those friends should, as an experiment, go hire
a handmaiden. On Craigslist.
And then report back to us on how that all went.
I'm sure you have to sign an NDA or something.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah.
You might. But then we're just asking the friends who did the hiring to come explain.
Right, yeah,
how
they
it
can
all
tell us
out.
Everything. True.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, no, I just never even occurred to
me. Nina Hartley is fascinating.
Oh, man. I was like... Lady, when's your memoir coming out?
Yeah, I can't believe she hasn't written one yet.
She's apparently written a sex guide that has some autobiographical elements to it, but I was like...
She needs to go full on memoir.
Yeah, she's got some stories.
Yeah.
A lot.
All right, movies.
Yeah, the hopping.
This is a podcast of the cinema.
That's right. Sorry. And Nina Hartley is a legend of the cinema.
She is.
Of a specific kind.
Well, she was in Boogie Nights, so she's done legit. Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Shall we kick it in with the one that people are really excited about this week?
Which one is that?
Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas.
Oh, my God.
Begin. Which our guest was kind and brave enough.
No, you strongly encouraged me to go see that.
Because I knew you'd have things to say.
What? Okay, did you see it at the Burbank Mall like we did?
Yes, and
How long has it been since you've been in that mall?
Since I saw Disney's Hercules in that very same theater.
Whoa.
Yes.
We go there a lot because the bad movies are always there.
And I'm obsessed with that store, Magnifique Mademoiselle.
They are now taking orders for Golden Globe and Oscar dresses.
Yes, I saw that.
Okay, here's my new favorite thing. My new favorite thing about Magnifique Mademoiselle. Mademoiselle.
Yes.
Is that every month or so when I'm in that mall to see some bad movie at that theater, they are closed for a break or lunch.
That's true. Every time I walk past it. Back in 20 minutes.
There's a sign that says, be right back, went to get some lunch. Or, be right back, just taking a break. I'm like, what? How are you going to sell all your prom and Oscar and Golden Globe gowns?
If no one's in there.
If you're not there waiting for the customers to come in. What happens when Meg Ryan walks in?
Marissa Tomei does not have all day to wait for you to come back to your cigarette break.
These celebrities
need their gowns.
They need their gowns. And they can't be expected to go hang out at the Cinnabon like we do.
Yeah. Oh, by the way.
Waiting for Magnifique Mademoiselle to reopen.
The AMC will not let you bring in items from outside.
No. Yeah. You can't bring your Orange Julius in?
No. Like, you'd think that their concession stand was so comprehensive that, you know, they could make you their own culotta, so you wouldn't have to get one at Cinnabon. No, you just can't bring one.
That's a sad little concession stand they have there.
It's a sad little theater.
Well, it's one of those old mall theaters that just hasn't changed with the times.
No. It's just it's this long corridor of sadness.
Right.
And, I was just there not long ago for Atlas Shrugged Part 3, Who is John Galt? Right. Which is the kind of movie you go see at the AMC. Program.
Right, right.
So you got the full experience. I'll tell you, and of course they showed the trailer for that Hillsong concert movie.
When's that coming out?
It always just says coming soon.
Warner Brothers just putting it out.
I turned to Dave and I said, I can't wait for this movie to come out so that I never have to see this trailer again.
Now, are they a real legitimate thing with the crowds that they showed in the trailer?
Yeah,
are they?
So.
Okay.
Oh, they're huge.
Among the evangelical.
They are huge.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Because I've never heard of them.
You've got a while before that trailer stops.
Oh, boy.
It is opening April 1st, 2015.
Ooh. And for April Fool's Day. Great.
And how long has it been playing?
The trailer's been playing for a couple months.
Right. Yeah, I saw it attached to...
Left Behind.
Left Behind, of course. Yeah.
Of course.
And something random, like something that wasn't even religious. It was like, okay. They're apparently huge among a certain segment of the population,
right.
And bully for them.
Okay,
so Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas. Is this even a movie?
It is not a film. And I'm not talking about this is not a film in the Jafar Panahi way. I'm talking about this is literally not a film. Like, this is...
A camera
that was pointed in the direction of some people sitting in the front of a minivan.
Yes! What was that choice?
A bad one. It was a bad choice.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about it from a theological perspective just yet. I want to talk about it's
purely cinematic.
As a purely cinematic experience, as a film, this is a Sunday school PowerPoint lesson.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a movie. Explain what happens.
Okay.
First, explain the introduction.
All right. We open on Kirk Cameron sitting in a comfy chair in front of a roaring fire and a huge, brightly decorated tree, sipping cocoa from a red mug, except he's not.
There's no cocoa in the mug.
There's nothing in that mug. That mug is so empty, and he is not an actor enough to fake it.
A digression already
mm-hmm.
that I have to tell the audience. Cocoa is referenced no fewer than 9 to 12 times in this film.
Yes.
Both as a physical act of drinking,
mm-hmm.
and it's never being drunk.
Or as a holiday signifier.
Or as a signifier, and...
Or as Ice-T's wife.
Cameron... Exactly. Kirk Cameron himself talks about cocoa and hot chocolate many times
during
this movie, as though it were the trump card in some argument. And the whole film is an argument.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A one-sided
but,
one.
But something about the cocoa...
Nobody argues back.
No. Something about the cocoa in this movie is like him dropping the mic. And cocoa! And...
Before Chanel.
And it doesn't make any sense other than this is a strange little, like fetish doll that he's rubbing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He clearly has some again. Very special cocoa memories. Yeah. That, sure. You know.
And I mean, I have them too.
Sure.
I too enjoy cocoa. I like to get under the blanket and drink the cocoa and watch The Sound of Music. It's great.
Cocoa is the reason for the season.
That's what I want to do. I'm with him on the cocoa, but it is not meant to bolster your points.
No, not so much.
No.
So I have to say, for the first two, maybe 3 minutes of the movie, I was agreeing with Kirk Cameron. He was saying about how the holidays are great, mm-hmm. and how everybody gets together and sure. decorate and gifts and yeah. food and da-da-da. I'm like, yes, absolutely. You're right, Kirk Cameron. And then he talks about how there's some people, and he gestures to one side, that want you to tone it down and, you know, not celebrate Christmas so much and keep it to your house and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. Here comes the war on Christmas.
Yeah.
And then he says, and then there's these other people who you'd think were on your side, but they're being big wet blankets and don't want blah, 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 blah. And then I realize, wait, who's this movie aimed at exactly?
Right. Yeah.
And then we come to find out once the movie itself starts in earnest, we're now at a Christmas party at Kirk's sister's house, who is played by Kirk's sister. And she is unhappy because her husband is being a big pill and sulking in the corner in a really dumb-looking Christmas sweater and picking his teeth.
With a hole in it. The sweater had a hole in it.
The sweater has a hole in it. As I couldn't stop looking at the hole.
Yep.
And he is, get this, Christian.
That's the character's name.
And he is this movie's straw man, who is there just to lose every argument with Kirk Cameron because he doesn't have anything to say in response to Kirk Cameron.
You talk about it like they even have arguments.
You're right. Well, he is the recipient of Kirk Cameron's monologue.
Exactly. Of his sermon.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, okay, so he's all frowny about Christmas and eventually decides to duck out and sit in the front seat of his minivan and get away from all the festivities and the hoopla. So Kirk Cameron goes out to talk to him, and so then, yes, we now are going to spend the next hour or so in the front seat of this minivan watching these two have a, quote, conversation, unquote. So the guy rattles off all these talking points about how the trees and Santa are pagan symbols and how the money on all the gifts could be better spent on, you know.
Well, the tree is a pagan symbol and Santa is an object of material.
Right, isn't, mm-hmm. And he isn't yeah. Jesus. And how, like, all the
and
money...
he's replaced Jesus.
Right, and all the right. money that we're spending on presents could have been used to, like, feed kids or dig wells and
right.
da-da-da. And so, like
valid
the,
points?
Yeah, all these sort of valid points, especially for somebody who is a serious Christian, might make. And then Kirk Cameron comes back with all of his counter-arguments that completely decimate Christian because he is unable to, like, answer any of them, even though there are answers to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that Kirk Cameron is saying, look, this stuff exists and we have incorporated them as rituals, but there's a way for them to be relevant to Christians. That's one approach. And if you wanted to say that, fine. You know, if that's what you need to sort of re-embrace the holiday from your point of view, great. No, 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 no. What Kirk Cameron wants to do is to ignore history and science in the classic way that many evangelicals do in trying to make a point about whatever social or economic thing they're trying to defend, and say that no, 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 all along these have been secretly, biblically based things, and that all that stuff you heard about the Saturnalia and the Yule and the winter solstice is bunk. And then he proceeds to talk about all these things over really bad reenactments of, like, St. Nicholas as a pro wrestler who beats the crap out of somebody who denies the divinity of Jesus.
That scene was surprisingly violent.
Yes. Quite, yeah. I think that's why this got a PG rating.
PG, yeah.
Then there's the Christmas tree lot that's shot entirely indoors.
Yes.
That then suddenly magically has a crucifix in the middle of it.
Yes.
And anyway, so then Christian learns to love Christmas again and does a slow-mo belly flop right into the gifts at the bottom of the tree, at which point the gifts are then described as looking like the skyline of a new Bethlehem?
The New Jerusalem.
New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And then there's a hip-hop dance number.
Oh, no, 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 no. You talk about it like it's a modern hip-hop dance number.
Yeah.
This is a breakdance scene straight out of the 1980s.
True. Yeah.
Done by very white people.
Yeah. Yes, yes. It is Yuletide Boogaloo, if you'll forgive me for that.
I hate to use this word because it's a word you should use when you're talking about real films, but formally... This barely counts as a movie.
Yeah.
It is...
It's an industrial film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is... I'm not joking. We've said this now twice, three times, but they point the camera at two people sitting in the front of a minivan. Mm-hmm. One of them talks, and the other one says, "You're right, you're right,
you're right." I didn't think about it that way. Oh, you're right.
Yeah, like, okay, at one point he says Jesus wasn't even born in December. And this is actually a historically backed up fact. And the Emperor Constantine in about 300 AD decided that it would be celebrated in December. And all Kirk's argument is, says who? Where'd you read that? And the guy's like, Wikipedia? I don't know. You're right.
Yeah. And as Chris was saying while we were eating the pancakes, all the reenactments are done in this sort of slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can listen to Kirk Cameron
talk,
Kirk-splain over and over and over again, and to fill it is a way to visually stretch the film so that it can hit its 80-minute running time.
Right.
Yeah.
And accommodate the length of time that he needs to blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
It's a 80-minute long sermon.
Basically.
In terms of.
With 75% of the film is voiceover.
Right.
Yes.
In terms of the content, I think that in a way, Kirk Cameron is actually performing criticism. And I don't mean like in a review, but I mean like he is referencing texts to make his case.
Right.
Now, his references are strictly associative. They are not, you know, this happened and then this happened and now we have Christmas. His references are, there was a tree.
In Genesis.
And then they call the cross sometimes, you know, he died on a tree. That is a thing that people, you know, evangelicals sometimes say, especially in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo,
Christmas trees. Well, that's okay. That's fine. If that's what you want to,
exactly. That's what your if that spin. Is how, great.
It's fine for people who want to read Christmas in a specific way.
Sure.
And it's a reading that places every American tradition of Christmas of the past 150 to 200 years in a very comforting context for conservative evangelicals, and each one of these readings contains some sort of oblique antecedent in the Old or New Testament. And it's okay to deconstruct like that. But you have to announce, I am deconstructing. I am not presenting history. I am presenting my interpretation. I am reading Christmas as this thing so that we and what we do, it can be viewed as a biblical...
Relevant and meaningful.
Construction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now,
but no,
they in have real to, life, you have to accept historical facts as historical facts.
Right, you can't rewrite this stuff.
Kirk Cameron has refused to do this to have some sort of claim on spiritual authenticity.
Well,
he doesn't care about actual authenticity.
It's that brand of evangelical fervor that's basically like Christianity to win.
Yeah, no, in his mind, his version has to win, or else the bad people have won Christmas.
And in this film, there's no one to challenge his assertions.
Right, no.
And so, therefore, Kirk wins. And to the audience, Kirk wins.
Yeah. He is a complete idiot.
And there were a lot of stretches in there. Like, when he explained that Jesus was God materialized on the earth, and yeah. so therefore materialism during the holidays is okay.
Yeah. Yes.
What the hell? Yeah.
I thought that was a particular stretch.
Yeah.
And that must be the reason for my two favorite characters in the film. The twin side-by-side gigantic Sub-Zero refrigerators that are in their kitchen.
Yes. Next to a tragically empty wine refrigerator.
Yeah. They shot this, I am going to guess, this in Kirk Cameron's house.
I bet you anything.
And Kirk Cameron has a lot of food in his refrigerators. He has so much food. And I looked at those Sub-Zeros and I thought, oh gosh, all the food I could put in those, all the Christmas foods that I could store, in, like I could make the Yule log, I could make the bouche like a few days in advance and store it in its on its own special serving tray in one of my Sub-Zeros, you know?
And that's what Christmas is all
the
about.
The cakey trifles and the peppermint. I stopped thinking about the film and stopped listening to the film.
And started coveting those Sub-Zeros.
And started thinking about those two gigantic refrigerators and all of the Christmas food treats that would lie inside them.
It's pretty easy for them to steal focus from anyone else in the movie.
Yeah.
They're more compelling characters.
I am a huge fan of those refrigerators now. Where does he live? Kirk Cameron.
I'm going to guess Orange County. Just a hunch.
Kirk.
I know you're listening.
If you're listening, I know I just called you an idiot. But I'm an idiot who loves to eat. And I would really love to be invited to your home for some eating. I come from the same world of evangelical Christianity that you come from. Y'all kicked me out, but I'm still down for you guys.
Are gays better if we stay in the kitchen the way you think women should?
Yeah, I promise. That. I promise to stay in the kitchen with the lady folk and only focus on the food. That will be my Christmas gift to you, Kirk Cameron. If you are listening, please be listening. Please invite me over to enjoy your refrigerators. I just want to touch them. Like we have a couple friends who are straight up rich. Mm-hmm. They don't even have these twin Sub-Zero fridges.
No. Wow.
Yeah.
They were staggering. And so in a way, this is lost the joke. Never mind.
That was
aspirational. In a way, this is an aspirational film.
Yes.
There we go.
It was I've seen Nancy Meyer movies that didn't have as much masturbatory kitchen implements as these two refrigerators. Amy Schumer did a bit about that at point about masturbating to Nancy Meyer's movies. Masturbating to the kitchens in the Nancy Meyer movies.
Yeah.
So I didn't just make that up. That's where that came from. Saving Christmas, my favorite refrigerators of cinema in 2014.
There's a scene where this one guy starts going off on the war against Christmas and chemtrails and fluoridated water.
That was weird.
That was a goof. They were goofing on paranoid Christians.
Right, I understand that. But here's the thing.
That was meant to be comedy.
In this context, for somebody who is not well-versed in what these guys consider normal,
because they wrapped Fox News in there and chemtrails.
When what you say with a straight face sounds almost as crazy as the thing you are presenting as satire.
Exactly. Yeah.
You gotta get your game.
Yeah. You have to really get exaggerated because otherwise, I just think this is what you guys believe on a daily basis.
Right.
Yeah.
This was a movie made by evangelicals for evangelicals.
Yes.
Yes.
And
the thing is, I mean, ultimately, all of these movies are. I mean, if you ask the people who make them, they will tell you that they are trying to, win over converts and, get the new...
That was my thought going into this movie, that they were going to try and win me over to their point of view.
Yeah.
And it was nothing of the sort.
But they never do.
I would like to tell you a little story.
Please.
This is an incredibly embarrassing story that I'm about to tell you. Back when I was a freshman in college, and I was still deeply involved in the conservative evangelical church, it was a moment when they had convinced me that I should stop listening to the good music I liked and should only begin listening to Christian rock.
Oh.
Which I did, dutifully, for about a year. And there was a terrible Christian rock band at that time. I'm not going to bring up who they are.
Okay.
And I bought 2 tickets because I thought, well, someone's going to go with me.
Oh, God, I know this story. Go on.
And there was this dude that sat next to me in my political science class. He was so good looking. This guy was so hot. This guy was so hot. And we became sort of friendly. And in my head, I didn't understand why I liked him so much. I understand this now. That I'm a very, very old man. But when I was 18, I did not get it.
Right.
And I just loved sitting next to him. And, like, I was really good at lying to myself about being a homo. But it didn't, I would never acknowledge that this was what was really going on in my head. But he, over the time of getting to know him and sitting next to him in class, eventually I asked him if he wanted to go see this band with me. I was asking him out on a date
to see a Christian rock band.
And he said no. And he said no. And then he changed his seat the next day.
Because
he got it.
Yeah.
He knew. He got what was happening. He got what I was doing. And I didn't even get what I was doing. Now, here's the thing. Here's the reason I tell this story. When you invite someone to see your Christian rock band, you're doing no one any favors. You're not going to win anybody to Jesus. And the reason you're not going to win anybody to Jesus is because your Christian rock band is terrible. So bad. Such a bad approximation of rock and roll that you're going to lose. You will have wasted your ticket money and your time. You think that all of your culturally creative efforts to win people to Jesus are going to be effective, and they aren't. And the reason they aren't is the reason we've talked about on this show before. You drove all of your artists out of the church because artists question things.
Yeah, right.
And what you have left behind in the church are people who will make mediocre stuff and put a label on it, put a Christian label on it, and then hope that someone pays attention to it. Mm. And they won't. Because it's terrible.
Well, there's only so much material you can...
Like, I mean, confused gay boys are going to ask each other straight boys out on dates and not even know that they're doing it. It's going to be a big disaster and everyone's going to be sad. And you're never going to get to look at his great legs and shorts again for the rest of your life.
You know, the only...
My heart is breaking.
It's a heartbreaking story.
The only movie I ever saw that made me consider going back to church after college before I went full bore atheist was The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
A movie that the people who make films like this would want banned and picket it against. That's the one movie that actually made me think, oh, okay. That's the only film I've ever seen that made me get the notion of Jesus as a mortal. As a mortal,
right?
You know, sort of risking something and not knowing if, you know, dying was going to be dying. You know, all the other ones, it all felt very much like, can we get on with this, please? Mm-hmm. I got to save mankind. You know, so what are you going to do? Were you raised particularly?
No,
I
became an atheist in the 5th grade.
Wow.
Yes, and I remember the exact point. It was
when you learned there was no Santa Claus.
No, it was I was in a science class or something. We were learning about the solar system or something, and it just clicked with me. Oh my God, there is no God. Right. And I have been since then, and I've been very comfortable with it. And I'm not an evangelical atheist.
Right.
I don't try and force my views on anybody else.
Yeah.
And I kind of expect the same of my religious friends. Mm. And that's why I have a problem with evangelicals.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm not.
Because they are assuming that your well-thought-out belief system or lack of belief system is wrong.
Of course, yeah. And you know,
well, it's a project for them to take on.
Yeah.
And it's a mountain for them to climb.
And it's a numbers game. Yeah. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
You know? They're always closing.
Mm-hmm.
They want the Glengarry leads.
Yes.
So yeah, so it's Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas, a movie that has the gall to think that it can have funny outtakes over the credits when the whole thing is an outtake.
Right. Wait a minute, were there? I left right as soon as the
Stay through the credits. All the time.
It was an 80-minute movie. Come on.
Okay. Oh, I should have stayed. Well, the credits started to roll, and I'm like, okay, is there going to be anything? And there wasn't anything, and I'm like, okay, I'm out of here.
They stuck out with you. Dave, do you want to talk about the backstory of the filmmaker at all, who also plays Christian?
Oh yeah, he used to direct music videos for like Blink 182 and people like that.
And then apparently was making a lot of Christian music videos.
Then his life changed in somehow. Yes. I mean, in ways that we can see because he wrote and directed this film.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Kirk Cameron didn't even write this stuff. The guy in the driver's seat listening to Kirk Cameron wrote all this stuff.
So he's saying, you're right, to dialogue that he already
wrote.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. That's how religion works.
And then it was edited by a post group.
You write it yourself, and then you say...
And then you agree to it.
Yeah.
And then it was edited by a post group instead of a person.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, right. I did notice that. That was unusual.
That's
yes,
weird.
It's very unusual.
Yeah. Again, this is an industrial film.
Let's talk about Rosewater.
Oh, that's...
You saw it.
I did, and so did Mr. Yes, this was
the I still haven't seen it, and the reason I haven't seen it is one of the reasons you didn't like it.
Well, we'll look for that after we talk about it. Yeah. Chris, you want to sum up what it's about?
It's about a Newsweek reporter who was based in London and then went to Iran to cover the elections in 2009.
Yeah.
And he was accused of being a spy because The Daily Show interviewed him and jokingly said that he was a spy.
Right. And Jason Jones jokingly called himself a spy.
Right, exactly. And so he gets taken up by the Iranian regime and is imprisoned and is tortured for well over 100 days.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, the way that they are selling this movie, though, what the trailers keep telling you is that he sort of finds this inner resources to allow him to turn the tables on his captors and stuff.
Mm.
He does that once.
Once.
The rest of the time, he has a lot of conversations with his dead father and sister, who had been previously imprisoned by various different Iranian regimes. This was my problem with the movie, and some people are telling me that it's a dumb sticking point, but it was what I couldn't get past. Gael Garcia Bernal doesn't look Iranian, and which is fine if John Stewart, who wrote and directed it, mm-hmm. his first time, if the whole cast had been Mexicans, and so they all looked alike, mm-hmm. It wouldn't stand out that Gael Garcia Bernal looked different from everybody else. But when you cast him as the son of Shore Agdashlu...
Yeah.
And you have...
Who I love. Loved her.
Oh, she's great. Yeah,
loved her in this
always
movie.
Great. Love yeah. her. And then almost all the characters, you know, the extras and everybody else are mm-hmm. Middle Eastern. It just stands out how not Persian Gael Garcia Bernal is. And I never got past it.
I didn't have a problem with it. I actually... I was watching Fareed Zakaria this morning on CNN, and Jon Stewart and...
Marzani.
Yeah.
He was on.
They were both on. And I'm like, okay. Gael kind of looks like him.
Huh.
I can see why he chose him.
Hmm.
Okay. I haven't seen the real guy, so.
That was my reason. That was my reason. Because I saw that they cast him and I thought, that dude's Mexican. This is not. You.
That.
Maziar Bahari.
Yes.
How many Lebanese, Pakistani, you know,
Turkish,
Saudi, Turkish? How many of these guys, actors, are like? Oh, okay.
The interrogator is Danish, but he's of Persian descent.
Yes.
Ah.
Yes.
I've seen that dude in lots of stuff.
Yeah.
And the guy who plays the father is Turkish.
Okay.
Why? So many actors who want to. I every time this happens, I think about our friend. Erin Quill mm-hmm. and her husband, Korean superstar Cho Kong.
Yes, who I saw in a movie this week. That's opening later this year.
And I think to myself, how many times have I listened to Erin Quill talk about the casting, or sorry, the non-casting
right.
of Asian actors?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've become very aware of this thanks to Erin Quill. And now that when I see it, I just think, come on. You couldn't get a quality. It's just like Keenan saying that black women aren't ready to be on SNL yet.
Right.
We couldn't find any funny ones. Well, you're that's not true.
Yeah, you weren't looking.
You're not, it's not true.
And the thing is, it's not like Gael García Bernal is Matt Damon. Like, I mean, right. I mean, he's a great actor, but he's not...
I agree with you.
He doesn't open a movie in a way that...
Yeah, correct.
Like, oh, well, of course, you know, that was the for the investment in the film. I think Jon Stewart, for this kind of movie, could have cast a lesser-known or even unknown actor who was right for the part. Mm-hmm. Because I think really the selling point in this movie is, hey, it's Jon Stewart's movie.
Right. You know? That's the reason I wanted to see it. I wanted to see what Jon Stewart did with this story.
I guess I'm willing to hear other ideas on this subject, but for right now, that's a big sticking point with me. It's like, why did this happen?
So that that bugged me. And then also I just kind of felt like I had the same problem with Kill the Messenger. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw that
No.
one. Which is about the guy who broke the whole... selling drugs to raise money for the, you know, the Contras.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was kind of like, this is a fascinating true story. I think I'd rather see a documentary about it because the way you're telling it is just sort of like, well, this happened and this happened and this happened. Mm-hmm. Early on, you know, Jon Stewart sort of like unpacks his director bag of cool flourishes. There's a scene where he's walking down the street in London and like all these shop windows suddenly have his memories in them, and it's like
that was fast. Love that.
Yeah, thought that was kind of cool. But then I thought, all right, now if you're gonna have a movie about a guy who spends 100 plus days in a white walled jail cell, here's the time to let your imagination get a little freaky and like show us what's going on in his head, and mm-hmm. And all he got is ghosts.
I was
excited about seeing this, and I just kind of felt it feels like a missed opportunity.
I felt like it was a valiant first effort, but it was kind of film school. There was a definite first act, definite second act, definite third act, everything you learn in film school, you know, and film school 101.
And my thing is, and I talked about this in my review on The Wrap, it's like, if you're going to make a movie about a historical incident that we already know how it ends, mm-hmm. so we know this is based on the book by the guy who is going on TV with Jon Stewart,
right.
so we know he doesn't die, we know he gets out of jail and writes about the situation, then the movie has to... There's that has to get over that hump and still make us invested and still create suspense. And it can be done.
Apollo 13.
Argo, you know, 1776. There's a ton of movies that do it where you're like, oh my God, how's this going to go? And this one, I was just like, I felt like I was doing hash marks on the wall waiting for him to get out of jail. Because I was like, I know where this is going and I'm not interested in where it is now.
Yeah.
So let's get on with it.
All right, what's next?
Foxcatcher.
Who saw it? I saw it.
I haven't seen it.
We saw it.
You saw it.
And I saw it.
All right.
David Mark Schultz.
Those are two people.
Yeah, Dave and Mark
Schultz. Oh, I think you said David Mark. Okay.
Dave and Mark Schultz. Mm-hmm. Olympic gold medalists in wrestling in 1984. Yeah.
The movie never comes out and says it, but do you have a feeling that everybody who won a medal at the 84 Olympics kind of feels like there's an asterisk attached?
Why?
Because that was the one that the Soviets didn't show up for.
I don't know that there's an asterisk attached to that.
I don't know.
First of all, that was 30 years ago. And
well, the movie's set in 1987, so this was still fresh.
Okay,
it was in the back of my head the whole time, and I wondered if the movie's ever going to address it, and they didn't.
You know, every time there's an Olympics, there's some weird controversy going on, and some country is either not coming or whatever. And I don't think that's no. They won their gold medals.
No, I'm not.
Why do you hate the sport of wrestling?
I'm not denying it. I'm just saying. I'm wondering if for the
why do you deny?
Okay,
American superiority
because so
in
much
wrestling.
Because so much of this movie is about Mark Schultz wanting to go to the Seoul Olympics and win another medal.
Yes,
I kept thinking in the back of my mind, does he feel like the medal in '84 carries less weight?
There's because nothing
the Soviets
in the film that indicates
no.
That's a valid question.
It's never said, but I thought about it the whole time.
Nothing in the movie points to him thinking that about himself.
No,
or
this
his
is,
win.
This is just me bringing it in.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
And that was you banging your own mic. Actually, it was your iced coffee.
No, banging a lamp.
Banging a lamp.
A very metal lamp, apparently.
Andre, for the holidays.
Yes. So the... So they won the gold medals.
Mm.
And young Mark is recruited by bajillionaire... Mm. John DuPont,
right,
of the DuPont family,
yes,
to come to the DuPont estate known as Foxcatcher, to train. Mm-hmm. Now, what the movie doesn't give you is that there were a lot of athletes that trained at Foxcatcher. Swimmers.
Oh, really?
Wrestlers. Yeah. Huh. Not just wrestlers and not just Mark Schultz.
Well, there you do get other wrestlers, but I didn't know there were other sports. Interesting.
Hmm. But the... and so then begins their relationship.
Mm.
And that is the meat of the film. This cold, unhappy film where...
There's a weird father-son dynamic.
There may be some sublimated homosexuality going on the part of DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
What we know about him historically is that he was married one time in his 40s, and then the marriage was annulled mm-hmm. 90 days later. And although, again, any references to that in the film are kind of blink and you miss it.
Yeah, it's very veiled, but it's still there.
It is as though Bennett Miller, who's the writer-director... he's the director, and the writer is...
It's Emax Fry and Dan Futterman.
Emax Fry wrote Something Wild,
uh-huh. mm-hmm.
and Dan Futterman wrote Capote.
Right.
And it is as though the creative team sort of intentionally left out any explanatory moments.
Yeah.
As though... And I agree with this as a tactic,
mm-hmm.
because I think when films that are based in historical fact,
mm-hmm.
where the outcome is known, I mean, it's a matter of public record that John DuPont murdered Dave Schultz, the older brother, who he had also hired to come to Foxcatcher as an assistant coach.
Right.
Hmm.
It is a matter of public record that John DuPont murdered him
mm-hmm.
by shooting him. And then went to prison and died in prison.
Right.
And Dave and Mark Schultz now lives in the Pacific Northwest and coaches wrestling.
Yeah.
All right. So when this is...
And is a producer of this film.
And is a producer of this film.
Oh.
Now you know when this is... When a film is based on a true story,
mm-hmm.
there's I think, a demand on the part of audiences to need a psychological explanation.
Sure.
Why did this happen?
Well, a true crime story, yeah, absolutely.
And the film is very, very reluctant to give you a why.
Right.
And I'm really into that because I don't think you can distill this sort of thing down to one reason.
Sure.
And there are a variety of reasons, I think. What were you going to say?
Well, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I like that the movie doesn't give you all the answers and that you have to sort of parse out these little hints from here and there. But I think there's a difference between a movie that underlines everything for you and then a movie that doesn't have an everything to underline. Like, this movie is so steps away from giving you all the facts that you really are kind of left with, I guess, maybe this and that thing. And I don't dislike the film. I found it...
It leaves you with more questions than answers.
Definitely.
And so, I'm really into that.
But if you're okay with that going in, then, you know, I think you'll enjoy the film for what it does. But it does something that is challenging.
It's beautifully shot.
Yeah. It's very austere.
It's got this, you know, great sort of, again, cold, unhappy tone throughout.
Steve Carell seems cold. His performance makes him seem cold and unhappy.
He looks like mentally ill person. Yeah.
He looks like a baby goblin.
Yeah.
Is that a prosthetic nose?
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Is it distracting?
It's a little distracting at first, but I got used to it. What I think is also interesting about the film, you know, you talk about the multitude of reasons of why things are happening. It says a lot about what wealthy people think their wealth entitles them to.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In terms of control over other people, expertise in certain areas, mm-hmm.
They get to say, they get to have the last word.
They get to have the last
word. Or else you're fired.
Yeah. Okay. And, but it's like, you know, like, because DuPont, you know, he's like, he says, oh, I'm an ornithologist, and he hands off like, this book that he wrote, you know.
He wrote more than one book, actually.
Oh, really? Okay. Time, yeah. And, you know, and then, then he passes himself off as a wrestling coach, and he's making this documentary about himself and how great he is. And there's this great scene where Dave, who's played by Mark Ruffalo, is trying desperately to say that he thinks that DuPont is a mentor to him, mm-hmm. because that's what the director wants him to say. And he's just like, you know, and it's just that idea of like, it's like when celebrities become DJs, you know, they think that because they're famous, of course they're going to be really good DJs.
No, it's more than that. It's
rich
when
people
celebrities
think,
when celebrities become
healthcare experts,
spiritualists.
Oh, yeah.
When they start talking to you about how, you know, you have to start manifesting your desires.
Your secrets.
The universe will give you... Look, it happened to me. The universe gave me this because I willed it into being.
So, like, the idea that DuPont thinks that he's a wrestling coach, when on the few times that we see him try to act like one, he has no idea.
Right.
You know? But because he's rich and because he's paying for all these people to be there, and they're all wearing the Foxcatcher shirt, then clearly, yes, he's a coach, right?
Yep.
So, you know, that's
fascinating.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that manifests itself in various ways over the course of the story. And then Channing Tatum, we haven't mentioned, plays Mark Schultz.
And he's terrific.
He's quite good. He's also wearing a fake nose. Like, it's kind of flatter and swooshier. And I think he's got something in his mouth to make him look more ape-like.
More wrestly.
Yeah, I mean, there are these amazing wordless scenes between him and Dave where they're sort of sparring. Mm-hmm. And it's, you can see the affection and the competition.
Yeah.
And it's like watching...
Those are really beautiful scenes.
Yeah, but it's also like watching bonobos, you know, in the wild. Yeah. The way they like smack each other's head and, you know, grunt and push shoulders on each other and stuff.
Okay.
It's a film that actively goes out of its way to keep you at a distance, I think. But it's... I was never bored.
I said this in my review at movies.com. my favorite scene is the shaving scene where they are... where Carell and Channing Tatum are sort of in this really close physical contact. And Channing Tatum is wearing nothing but a pair of shorts.
Mm.
And as I watched it, I thought about the opening of this Russian movie I saw about 10 years ago, Alexander Sokurov's Father and Son. And in the opening of that film, an adult father and an adult son, an adult father. Of course he's an adult father. The father and the adult son.
Mm-hmm.
The father is comforting the adult son after the adult son has a nightmare. And it's this really very intimate scene where like he's like hugging him and it's in deep close up of like arms and legs and torsos, and they're holding each other and there's this grunting going on. It is as though they are wrestling. And it feels like a lot. It feels like Sokurov was sort of, you know, referencing like classical painting poses and stuff like that. But I thought about that scene when this scene was playing out, and I don't know if it was intentionally referenced or not. I don't know how deep Bennett Miller's appreciation of Alexander Sokurov films goes. But, you know, if no one in the listening audience has seen an Alexander Sokurov film, you should see all of them because they're amazing.
Oh, I should also mention that DuPont's mother is played by Vanessa Redgrave.
Yes.
And her disapproval can be seen from space.
Yeah.
Like, she is so not into, like, the idea of wrestling. It's just so, like, low and common and coarse.
Right.
But I think it's also because she realizes, like, why her son is so into it.
Right. And where I was going with the thing I was about
to say. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is that it was...
Did I dominate you?
I feel dominated right now, and it hurts me. It makes me... It diminishes me, and I would like you to apologize on the air.
Sorry.
Yeah, you get to see this in person.
No, a couple weeks ago, somebody... wrote it and said they didn't like me because I dominate.
You dominate, yeah. I heard that.
Ain't gonna change. Nothing's changing.
I'm just fighting for what's mine.
So anyway, you know, it just felt like this sort of this weird inversion of that, you know, where in one scene you've got a father comforting a son during a nightmare, and then the other one you've got this not father and not son, and this weird gnawing sort of interlocking need that they have, and it is the nightmare, like that and it, no one's going to wake up from this nightmare. It's just going to keep going. So I'm now doing filmically what Kirk Cameron does with the Bible in Saving Christmas. I took an old thing and associated it with a new thing.
Well done, sir.
Thank you.
Well played.
So I love this movie. I think it's really great. And I'm pretty... Oh, the Barbara Kruger thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It reminded me of... There's a 1981 work by the American artist Barbara Kruger. If I know it's owned by the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. Maybe it's hanging up in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts right now. Or perhaps it's out on loan. I don't know. But it's a photo of a group of men sort of happily roughhousing. Mm-hmm. They're all wearing suits like they're at a wedding reception or something. And in her sort of very signature cut-and-paste text, hostage text sort of style, it says, you construct rituals which allow you to touch the skin of other men.
You did elaborate rituals?
You construct elaborate rituals which allow you to, which allows you to touch the skin of other men. And this feels like that movie. These people who are so lost and in need of each other, or in need of something that they think the other is going to give them, so that they involve themselves in these pursuits that allow them to get close to someone and be touched, not sexually, just you know.
No, exactly. Right. No, I totally get that.
Everybody needs a hug.
I will disagree with your description of Barbara Kruger having hostage lettering because
you know it's not. I don't mean hostage lettering. I mean just yeah. That's not what I meant.
Yes,
but yeah.
I'm sure that's a specific font, like it's Futura or something.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone will comment and
in
let
terms
us know.
In terms of how she places those texts,
yes,
it resembles hostage lettering because it is often sort of
blocky on top of
it's something. It's often not like horizontal perfectly. It's askew. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's like an old magazine cigarette advertisement.
Yes,
there we go.
Yeah.
Barbara Kruger, alive with pleasure.
Yes.
You saw Beyond the Lights.
I did.
Which is, I'm hearing, being very undersold.
Apparently. Yeah. I don't know what their marketing situation is like, but, I mean, I saw Minnie Driver on Ellen this week, and I saw Nate Parker and Gugu Mbatha-Raw on Wendy Williams.
Yeah. That's a start.
So they were doing the TV.
Okay.
I saw the poster at the Burbank meet.
Well, then, that's really all you need.
Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who was in Belle, about the abolition of slavery in England.
Right.
She plays a biracial pop star named Nani or Noni, I can't remember now. And she's like Rihanna, she's like Ciara. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Timbaland featuring Ciara. And she's a new star. Like, she's had a few hit records, and she performs at, you know, the BET Awards or whatever. And she hates her life because the first thing we see her doing in the film is singing a Nina Simone song at a talent contest when she's 10. Mm-hmm. But it ain't feeling good. Like, she's not singing, you know... Sun is in the sky, you know what I feel. Like, it's that's not... She's singing Blackbird. Now, I don't know if you know Nina Simone's song, Blackbird.
She's not doing Strange Fruit, is she?
No. Close enough. Like, Blackbird is a really, really painful song, lyrically. Mm. It's about the sorrow of life.
Huh.
And so here she's 10. She's belting it out at a talent show. And she comes in second. And Minnie Driver grabs her by the hand. She's like, get out of here. They hate you. Take that award and throw it in the trash. You know, like,
oh, yeah. First or nothing.
10 years. Yeah, first or nothing. 10 years go by, and now she's Sierra. And she has little straps over her boobs. Like, and that's it. And, like, when the photographer, when Terry Richardson or whoever is like, take it all off, baby, for the camera. And Minnie Driver's like, yep, do it. Do it. Oh. Open it up. Spread your legs wider. I mean, like, it's that.
Wow.
Yeah. And so
it's like in Glitter, except there's no dice to protect her.
Except, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so so she's like, all right. Spreads the legs. And then she tries to kill herself. Now, this happens in the first, like, 15 minutes of the movie.
It's in the trailer. You're not getting it.
And it's in the trailer. Yeah, it's everywhere. She tries to kill herself by jumping off a balcony. And Nate Parker, the cop, who was in Red Tails and a bunch of other stuff, and who, I've said this a couple times to people, he has future Denzel hovering in neon lights over his forehead. Not only does he resemble young Denzel Washington, but he just gives off this, I'm going to be a movie star sort of face. Okay. He's extremely handsome. And he's the cop, and he just, like, one hand pulls her up to the balcony. And he says, and as he's pulling up, he's like, I see you. And, you know.
Well, all right.
Yeah. Although, would you like me to sing Blackbird for you right now? Because I might.
Yeah. I have to be fair, pulling up a pop star with one arm is not that much of a feat.
Well, yeah.
These trails are all 98 pounds soaking wet.
Yeah, there's even a scene where Minnie Driver takes a napkin and scoops the hash browns up off of the breakfast plate that Gugu and Bhadra is eating, leaving her with the egg whites and the roasted tomato. And everyone's like, you just took the best part of breakfast away, Minnie Driver.
Why you gotta be like that, Minnie Driver?
Yeah.
She might as well be Mommy Dearest.
She's gonna go eat it herself so that she can star in the sequel to Circle of Friends. She would need to eat a lot of hash browns to do that.
Yeah,
she gained a lot of weight.
We're never going to see Fat Minnie Driver again.
Yeah, I remember she gained a lot of weight back in the day for that. Because when I saw her finally promoting that film, I remember this thinking, what happened to you? You were adorably chunky in that film.
You were sweetly round.
Why are you... It was kind of like when I saw skinny Toni Collette.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, wait... You're Muriel, and you've got a big butt.
The betrayal that is skinny Jonah Hill.
Yeah. Like, when the first encounter I have with a famous person is that they are fat, I think, oh, you're so cute and fat. Stay that way forever.
Yeah,
and
then knock it off, Seth Rogen.
Don't.
And then they don't, yeah.
Oh, Seth Rogen is back.
Oh, we've got fat Seth Rogen back. Yes. Thank goodness.
He just did that video with...
order is restored in the
Green
world.
Green Hornet Seth Rogen is no longer...
Oh, yeah. He just did that video with James Franco, Naked and Afraid.
Oh, right. I want to see it.
So they fall in love. And it's very much like The Bodyguard, except it's not stupid.
That's a plus.
There's no serial killer chasing Gugu and Bhadra. There is more... mundane and gendered things chasing her. The tabloids and marketing teams and the record industry's horrible treatment of women and who they allow to be successful and why and what sort of bodies they will accept and just straight up like capitalism's monetary rewards for women who are sexually compliant and available and women who speak their mind and who are not sexually compliant and available. And so this is a film about a woman who actually has to save herself. Wow. And she does so in an interesting way until a really dumb, corny ending, which I don't even like to talk about because it bummed me out because I just thought, well, this was a very cool movie. Oh, silly, corny ending seems to not understand how life actually works. But it's fine.
The movie itself becomes victim to the same forces that prey upon the heroine.
Yeah, the movie. It's a good movie. In fact, I'd say it's a very good movie. And it's really sexy because when they're together, they're great. They are a good team. And they are making out quite a bit in this film. There are sex scenes in this movie. And they look good together. They're sexy together. And honestly, any movie by a black filmmaker.
Female filmmaker?
With a female black filmmaker that takes black relationships and allows them to just be, without judgment, without Tyler Perry nonsense, without...
slut-shaming?
Without slut-shaming. Yeah, it's like... It's almost miraculous. And the fact that these come along like once or twice a year in wide release and maybe are not comedies. Like now the remake of About Last Night, we both kind of liked.
Yeah.
But it was comedy, you know, and played that way. And this is not a comedy at all. Right. This is a drama. I'm into it.
Supports a film that is made by a black woman that is good.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I need to go see this and I will buy a ticket and hopefully that adds to something. I'm sure this movie is being sold like, you know, somewhat lackadaisically, and then they can, when it doesn't burn down the box office, they can point and say, nobody wants to see this.
Right. Right.
So yeah, it's irritating. Is that everything?
We've got Dumb and Dumber 2.
Oh,
and then National Gallery.
Dumb and Dumber 2, of course.
I was going to see that until you suggested that I see Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas.
And I think conversationally that was the right call to make you do that. But you know, I had fun Dumb and Dumber 2, I have to say. I mean,
co-written by our pal.
Friend, Bennett Yellen, who co-wrote the first one. It is exactly...
And who was at my screening, by the way?
Yeah, you told me.
My press screening. The press screening I went to. In he walks, strutting. He's got his whole gang of friends, Jeffrey and Raphael and Sean, all those dudes we know.
Yeah.
They're all on the row. They got a row together and everything. And I see Bennett.
The screenwriter doesn't get a lot of entourage moments. You
I know.
To let him have.
I see Bennett and I yell at him across the theater, "Get the F out of here." He's like, "What?" I was like, "This is a press screening. Go." He's like, "Where's your husband?" I go, "He recused himself from reviewing this film, which is what the journalistic integrity person does. I do not have that luxury. I have to review your movie and then write a little disclaimer in the review that, oh, yeah, I know the co-writer. You're not going to get much of a review out of me, just cheerleading." Well, thankfully, this movie is really funny.
Yes.
And incredibly stupid.
Totally. Yeah, thoroughly.
You don't expect anything.
Exactly.
Besides that.
It delivers what it promises.
Yeah.
And again, we are following the rule of if somebody that we know makes a movie and we don't like it, we shut up.
Right.
So the fact that we're even talking about Dumb and Dumber 2 is our tacit endorsement. it's exceedingly silly and moronic, but it is exceedingly silly and moronic at a good enough pace that the laughs keep coming.
Right.
Here are the things that Bennett had nothing to do with. The terrible editing.
The awful cinematography.
The awful cinematography and long stretches of weird dead air going on that didn't make any
sense. There are moments and this is a Farrelly Brothers thing, I think, where sometimes they hit a point somewhere at about the hour and 10 minute mark where they realize, oh, wait. We have to actually, resolve this plot.
There's barely a plot.
That we've painted ourselves into this corner of. So let's take about 5 minutes, and we'll just do these scenes that are going to address that, and then we'll get back to the pooping and the farting.
Right.
You know, so
the minute the movie begins, almost immediately, Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey are punching each other in the balls. It's
which is
almost
awesome.
That quick.
Jim Carrey is being dragged by a catheter before the credits come through.
Which is also awesome.
A catheter in his urethra is being dragged.
That's where catheters usually go.
Yeah, I know. But so the minute that happened, the minute he starts being dragged by the catheter, I'm sitting in the back, of course, going, ha ha ha.
I did miss the press screening because I had to go to another thing that night.
Yeah.
But over the next 2 days, like literally five different film critics said, "Well, you know, I went to the Dumb and Dumber 2. I could tell Dave was having a good time. I could hear him laughing in the back of the theater."
I was having a very good time. There's actual homophobia, racism, and misogyny in this film.
Yes, but being perpetrated by complete idiots.
And that is how they get away with it.
Yes.
Okay.
Because these are people who
are reprehensible
and stupid.
Yes.
Yeah.
And therefore, anything they say and do is sort of in that context what are you going to do about it?
And they are frequently the victim of their own stupidity by just doing awful, awful things to themselves, and or allowing awful things to happen to them because of their stupidity.
Here's what I loved, I think, the most: Kathleen Turner.
Oh God!
Because
I had no idea she's in this.
Oh yeah.
Oh, this is awesome. Oh God.
They mistake her for a man.
They first see her. They insult her so deeply and so horribly over and over again. And she never breaks face. Like, she stays glaring at the camera as though she's angry to be in the film. And I love that about her. That's sort of like, come on, say whatever you feel like saying. I'm Kathleen Turner. I will ruin you.
I will end you.
Yeah.
To me, it kind of, it felt like, yes, they're saying all this awful stuff. And the look on her face was just like, I can't even get angry because you guys are so stupid. So pathetic that, like, I have to just consider the source here.
Yeah.
Because the movie at large doesn't treat her like that. It's just them.
Right. Yeah, she's... Huh. She gives wonderful face.
Yeah.
Okay.
Deadpan is the perfect counterpart to their, like, blah, 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 blah,
And she, honestly, talking about bodies, she's such an excellent rebuke to everything. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that the woman who was...
Maddie in Body Heat.
Who was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Has grown old.
Yeah.
And thick. Mm-hmm. And doesn't care what you think.
Right.
And I'm kind of in love with her for that.
Yeah. It's like, she is that one of those rare people you can kind of point to and be like, didn't do crazy things and has a great career on the stage and occasionally pops up in movies, it could not be bothered to care about not fitting whatever crazy narrow definition of beauty is the current, vogue.
So, applause for Kathleen Turner.
Yes, always.
And for this
idiotic
film that I had a wonderful time at.
Me too.
Yeah.
Romance in the Stone, 30 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oof. Okay, now, I finally finished watching in chunks. What an ordeal this was.
Not that the movie wasn't good.
No. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So the publicists, I could not go to the... I don't think... There may have not even been a press screening.
I don't think there was.
The publicists sent me a DVD of the new Frederick Wiseman film, National Gallery, which is his documentary about London's National Gallery.
Mm-hmm. Wiseman likes to make a long movie.
Okay. Now, a short Wiseman movie is 2.5 to 3.5 hours long.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think The Store is less than 2 hours.
Is The Store 2 hours?
I think it might be.
Well, anyway, he likes them long these
days. Yeah, lately they've been long. Lately they send you 2 discs.
Yeah. So National Gallery is 181 minutes, 3 hours and 1 minute. Mm. And I started watching it on our DVD player and was interrupted by the UPS guy and the FedEx guy and the mailman and
the dogs downstairs
and the dogs that live downstairs and other neighbors and the
Bumpuses
the recycling truck going past and the garden. I was watching it on a Thursday. The gardeners when they come on Thursday to
with
tend
the leaf blowers
with the leaf blowers to tend to the apartment buildings, greenery outside. This is a very quiet film.
It's in a museum.
Set in a museum. And every 10 minutes, something got in the way. I'd have to pause it. I'd have to go tend to something. It took me days and days and days to work my way through this film. Because of that, I am going to tell you about how great it is right now. But it opens. It has... opened in Los Angeles. No, I'm sorry. It opened in New York already. It opens in Los Angeles on the 21st, this coming Friday.
Uh-huh.
I am going to go to whatever Lemley Theater is showing it, and I know it's going to be a Lemley.
Right.
And I'm going to sit down and enjoy all 181 minutes in a quiet movie theater, uninterrupted, because it's that good that I would like to see it again. but I just need the experience of just being able to, to sit and watch this movie. Now, it is
going to sit down and they'll say, sorry, we need the theater for spillover for Hunger Games.
Right, yeah. 80-something Frederick Wiseman is an old master.
Yes, he is.
And this is a movie about the old masters.
There we go.
He is, it's about the museum. It's about the museum that houses the old masters in London. It is, like all Wiseman movies, there's no narration, there's no talking head, there's no explanation, no Chirons telling you who anyone is.
Yeah.
You, if you care enough to go do a little hunting after the film,
mm-hmm.
you can go find out that that is the guy who runs the museum that is talking in the budget meeting.
Right.
Or you can find out what the specifics are about the Greenpeace protest in one scene that takes place on the outside of the building. You can go hunt down all this stuff.
So it's pure cinema verite.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, depending on your definition.
Depending on your definition, yes.
Some people say cinema verite, like you have to actually see members of the crew.
Oh, okay.
Like,
right.
you know, Memories of Summer or
yes.
something.
Yeah.
So this just sitting, putting a camera in the National Gallery.
In the strictest definition, yeah. it is not. But in,
okay.
in the functional definition, yes.
Okay.
You get to see... So anyway, that's his style. It's strictly observational. And it goes all over the place.
Hmm.
But it's really expertly, quietly... controlled. You see the people who are the conservators. You get to see people who are, you know, restoring works. Hmm. You get to see people just going to exhibitions and looking at the art. There are life drawing classes that you get to watch. There's a class for the blind. There's a class for the blind where they're all like looking at a sort of, they're all touching a sort of topographical version of like this Pissarro painting. You know, you hear the docent, you know, tours and the Greenpeace protest that takes place at one point. These budget meetings that are...
What is Greenpeace protesting?
There was a thing happening in London that was... I think it was Mobil or Exxon had something to do with...
Oh, they're like sponsoring
some event. Gotcha. At the gallery, and Greenpeace got up on top of the gallery and unfurled this giant banner.
Awesome.
Yeah. And these budget meetings where very British testiness is taking place. it's so cool to be a part of that, just go behind the scenes stuff.
It sounds very Wiseman.
And my favorite Wiseman thing, the janitors and the custodial crews and the floor buffers. And I was watching the guy buffing the floor in one scene and thinking, what a great job that would be. Like, A, fun to run the floor buffer. B, you get to work in the National Gallery and you get to buff the floors under the Rembrandts and just like hang.
Look at art.
It's not like you're thinking about tons of stuff while you're buffing the floor. Once you learn to operate the buffer, again, a fun task.
See, you were asking, how do people listen to this show when they're at work?
Yeah.
If you're the floor buffer at the National Gallery.
I just, yeah. you know, I had that moment of envying, like, the guy who buffed the floors at the National Gallery. Like, that would be a cool job. I could do that job. I would like to have that job. There's the stuff about... the integrity of the space versus the need to keep, you know, butts in seats, as it were. Ideas, you know, about the nature of history and how it shapes what we think of as, like, art masterpieces and what we think of as even good, you know, museum practice. Because we learn in the process of the film that the museum was funded in the very beginning by the slave trade.
Oh,
and there's a historian that talks about it. And she's like, we must always remember that this museum was built on the slave trade.
Wow.
And
like the pyramids.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's just you see him cleaning a Rembrandt. It's just all about the ways that, you know, we build institutions and maintain them and how we live with them. And as always, like in a Frederick Wiseman movie, there are no guideposts. It's just very quiet and meditative. It's so great. Great. It's such a beautiful movie. I'm going again.
Right.
It is one of the best. It's the best documentary I've seen all year, and it's one of the best movies I've seen all year.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. All right.
Is that it? Is that everything?
That's it. Want me to read a letter?
Sure.
Then we're done. I don't want to take our guests' time.
I'm having a blast.
We have things to sell, so we're not done.
Okay, short letter. Hi, Alonzo and Dave. I wanted to add another word to the linoleum knife vocabulary. Are you familiar with the adjective glauque?
Spell?
G-L-A-U-Q-U-E. Rhymes with coke.
No.
I have yet to find a good English translation, but it refers generally to any film so grim and depressing as to make you wonder if you'll ever be happy again.
So, whatever, and in his parentheses, Dave likes.
In parentheses, he writes, see Bullhead.
You should get a t-shirt with glauque on it.
That is from Rene.
Oh, thank you, Rene.
Thank you.
We'll start incorporating that one into our daily usage.
Glauque.
Glauque. Do you have a DVD pick, sir?
Do I have a DVD pick?
Do you want it to be Father and Son?
I don't think it's available on DVD.
Oh.
I think most of the Socorro films are not available.
Well, you can get Russian Ark and his Faust just came out on
Blu-ray. I've recommended those before.
Right, okay, yes.
Well, you know what you can get? You can, through Zipporah Films, you can buy a DVD of The Store.
Oh, yeah. Which is...
We may have actually recommended this in December's past, but... Why not re-recommend it again?
Sure.
See Frederick Wiseman's The Store. If you've never seen a Frederick Wiseman movie, this is a great place to start.
Yes.
It's short-ish. It's about 2 hours long.
Yeah.
It is set in the downtown Dallas Neiman Marcus... The flagship store during the Christmas season of 1982.
Okay.
And it's riveting.
It's the only documentary in my Christmas movie book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
Yes, which you can buy. Tell them about that.
Sure, you can just PayPal us $20 at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com for postage within the United States. Let us know where you want it sent and how you want it signed, and Dave will throw in a few little extra...
Oh, no, not a few little extras. So many excellent extra treats.
Okay, so many
inside your copy of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
More than just stickers.
More than just stickers this time. More than just a beautiful Christmassy ribbon to use as a bookmark. This is, you're getting groovy stuff this time around.
That's why you want to get it from us directly.
And so, I mean, I don't want to oversell it, but it's terrific. And
groovy and flat.
They're okay. all flat things. Yeah, $20. We even gift wrap it.
Yeah.
So it's like if you give yourself this as a gift, you could put it under your tree and save it for Christmas Day, and you get to unwrap it because it's our present to you.
Although you might want to open it sooner so you can enjoy the movies during this festive holiday season.
All you need is your DVR for that.
Fine. My DVD pick this week is also a movie that's in my book. There's a new Blu-ray of Remember the Night. Written by Preston Sturges and starring Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck. If you're used to seeing them as the murderous couple from Double Indemnity, you will be stunned at how adorable they are in this one. She plays a shoplifter and he's a New York DA, and he, so that she doesn't have to spend Christmas in jail, takes her home with him to Indiana, where they visit his mother, played by Beulah Bondi, who plays George Bailey's mother in It's a Wonderful Life. And, of course, they fall in love, because how could they not? It's right. Sweet and funny, and a movie that not a lot of people know about. It really kind of has had a bit of a revival in the last few years. TCM kind of unearthed it. I think, actually, TCM is putting out this Blu-ray. Highly recommended. A great Christmas movie that you may not have seen before, and I think that you'll really like. Chris, you got one?
I have a Netflix pick, if that's okay.
We'll take it.
Yes. First time I've ever seen this. I've read about it quite a few times and read how fascinating it is, but I finally saw Three Women this year.
Oh, I love that movie.
Great movie.
And the comparisons, I immediately drew a comparison between that and Mulholland Drive. Yeah, sure. The way characters just kind of just drifting shatter in. Like glass and reassemble themselves after a certain period of time. Mm. And it's the most quiet Robert Altman movie I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's up there, definitely.
And you don't have a million people talking over each other the other ones.
Right, exactly. And it was fascinating. It was very dreamlike. And I'm really glad I saw it this year, and it's available on Netflix.
Oh, cool. Okay. Also on Netflix is Los Angeles Plays Itself, which is what we've talked about a lot.
Is it on Netflix?
It is on Netflix now, streaming.
I endorse both of these.
Okay. All right.
I have to tell my three women story. I probably told it on the show before, but what the heck. Years ago, when I was in Dallas doing the USA Film Festival, at our kid film festival that we had, we showed a movie that starred Skylar Fisk, who is the daughter of Sissy Spacek and her husband Jack Fisk, the production designer.
Right.
And so, at one point, like, the movie was running, Skylar was off somewhere literally doing her homework, because she was, you know, a teenager at the time. Now she's a musician, I think. And so I'm standing in the lobby of a movie theater with Sissy Spacek. I'm like, what are we talking about? So I said, hey, so I just saw Three Women recently, because I didn't see it until, like, the 90s.
Right.
She said, really? Did you understand it?
Well, Altman is famous for saying that he really didn't understand the ending.
And I said, not really. And she goes, me neither. So that happened. Yeah. All right. Well, Chris LaVoy, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Guy Chris. You can follow me on Facebook. I'm Producer Chris. And you can go to stephaniemiller.com to find out about the Stephanie Miller Show.
Yes, which is, again, it's available. It may well be on the radio near you. It's available. It's worldwide on Free Speech TV.
Worldwide on Free Speech TV. Go to freespeech.org if you want to watch the streaming video of us every morning from 6 to 9 Pacific time.
Nice.
And we're on Sirius XM Progress 127 at 9 o'clock Eastern.
Awesome.
And your XTube channel is crazy.
Yes, it certainly is.
Well, listen, we are thrilled that you were here today. We thank you for your ongoing support. You've worn the shirt on television and everything.
Absolutely.
Super awesome.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, no, you've been a delight. I just want to remind everybody real quick, of course, to check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Subscribe to the Popcorn Mafia podcast with our friends Matt and Gray. The B-Movies podcast from Bibbs and Whitney. Dennis Hensley's Dennis Anyone podcast, of course, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, the Schmoes Know, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. As always, we thank Blue for our awesome theme music, which may or may not sound like something that the Smurfs created. Of course, reminding you, you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes, and if you want to leave us a positive review there, that would be great. It does help people find the show. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com, or on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can subscribe. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at TVTag.com. And once again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Drop us a line with questions or comments. It's also the place to PayPal us for our awesome stuff. Again, $20 for my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, within the United States. $20 for a Linoleum Knife t-shirt within the United States. It's a Hanes Beefy Tee, 100% cotton.
Before you do that, check with one of us about size availability.
Oh, are we running out of things?
We're running low on
larges. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you want a large, act now.
We may have like one large.
Okay.
Left,
so
maybe.
So get on it if you've been putting it off. But yeah, let us know what size you want and where you want that shipped. You can also, of course, purchase our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes. White Christmas, which is now coming around to being that time of year again to enjoy that. Also, Clue, the one we forgot last week.
Yep.
Clue, the apple. Two
I was
for the
shouting
road.
That at my radio.
I'm sure you were. I felt really stupid about that later. Clue, Two for the Road, The Apple, and Joe. The Pussycats. We will in very near future be taping our latest
Christmas episode. We're doing it this week.
This week we will be taping our commentary episode for the Mexican Santa Claus, directed by Rene Cardona.
Yes.
I've already put a link to where you can watch that film legally on YouTube on our Facebook page. So if you want to watch along with that, it's also available on DVD and Blu-ray and in other various other places. And I think the TCM is going to be airing it in December.
Oh, are they really?
Yes, which is awesome.
Like on underground or just during the day?
I think maybe during the day.
That's
terrific. I'll have to look, but on one of their nights of Christmas movies, they're throwing that in there. Chris LaVoy, once again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we will catch the rest of you next time.
Goodbye.